can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT at 90.3 FM, feminist radio which believes in power of the people and an end to patriarchy. We're on the air the second Wednesday of the month here on CKUT at 90.3 FM from 6 until 7 p.m. My name is Rosemary Wally. I'm a member of our radio collective and host for this month's show. One place where we desperately need to see a change is the healthcare system, much of which is still controlled by money, which, of course, is the ultimate expression of domination. During the COVID pandemic, we've seen how vaccines have been distributed to rich countries, how pharmaceutical companies have seemed interested in control and the bottom line. Here in Montreal, we watch with horror as fragile and vulnerable old people were left to die in for-profit as well as state-run nursing homes. With the public system in crisis and more people questioning the care they are offered, more of us are turning to complementary and alternative medicine. Imagine you've heard of other kinds of treatment for your condition. Is it available in Quebec? Tonight, we're going to be looking at complementary and alternative medicine in Quebec with Dr. Sandra Hyde, a medical anthropologist and professor at McGill. She's also the daughter of two physicians, and as an undergraduate, Sandra was active in a feminist health collective. So thanks for joining us, Sandra.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us what is complementary and alternative medicine, just so that we're all on the same page?
Yes. Well, I often say that you can kind of look at complementary and alternative medicine on a kind of scale, right? So when we think of conventional medicine, we think that the idea, it's very disease focused. You're looking at, you know, you're treating the symptoms, you're using drugs, radiation, surgery, and it serves as a knowledge base for what we call Western biomedicine. Now, complementary and alternative medicine, there's a wide range. So there's alternative medicine, which is used in place of conventional medicine. So it treats the symptoms using medications that are what are quote unquote closer to nature. It treats not all treatments are scientifically validated through our evidence-based medicine gold standard system. And then we come to complementary medicine, which is a modern approach which combines what I would call conventional and alternative medicine to treat and diagnose a kind of hybrid approach. And then you get to integrative medicine, which really combines conventional and alternative medicines in a very coordinated way. And then you get to something which is not very well known in Quebec, but is very popular around the world, called functional medicine. And functional medicine actually questions the foundations of conventional medicine, and it treats the patient, not the disease. And it is scientifically based in biology, and it focuses on prevention rather than treatment.
Okay, so what has been your personal experience with complementary and alternative medicine?
Well, you know, I grew up in a household of two very highly medical specialists. My grandmother, believe it or not, my British grandmother was part of what was called the home health movement in Britain, and was a homeopath. And she was very much involved in, you know, particularly during World War II, when there was very little access to medical care because so many doctors were on the front, in developing alternative ways of treating. My mother, in response, opposed her treatments and went on to become a neonatologist. And in reverse, when I became a teenager, I became very interested in my grandmother's treatments and in alternative care. And I've been interested in complementary and alternative medicine, you know, since I was a teenager. And I've been treated many times in my life in many countries. I've worked in China for many years, where I've been treated with Chinese traditional medicine and acupuncture. And it was only when I came to Quebec that I realized that we had this sort of lopsided system here, where there were alternative practitioners that were available, but it wasn't recognized by the College de Medicine. And a lot of them were kind of hogtied in that they had no access to more sort of conventional diagnostic tools. So it's something I've always sort of questioned in a province that has healthcare in crisis, that it's not turned to opening every avenue and every door we can in terms of maximizing health.
Yes, and I know that we had a long, long tradition of so-called alternative and complementary medicine here. You know, we just have to look at the church and the monks and the mm-hmm. nuns. Of course, we have the first ever hospital in Canada, which is a Hotel Dieu just here in Montreal. So it's interesting and surprising what you're saying.
You know, yeah, it feels, you know, it feels to me like a big contradiction that on the one hand, you know, Quebec is on the cutting edge of a lot of social services, Like you think about, you know, Quebec, I think, is one of the few places in North America that has a very progressive childcare program. It has very extensive family leave programs, which also tie into, you know, wellness and whole person care, you know, balancing kind of mind, body, taking care of, you know, the parent and the child. And yet, on the other hand, there have been, you know, a series of witch hunts that have been going on in Quebec for people who combine, particularly combine what is called allopathic medicine, which is biomedicine and alternative medicine. And that always struck me as odd.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, for a couple of the examples, there was a doctor, there was a center here in Montreal that was set up purposely to integrate biomedicine and alternative medicine. And it was basically pulled apart by the Collège de Médecine. They went after one of the physicians in the practice and said that he was not practicing according to medical standards. They put him on trial. They were going to take his license away because one of his patients actually complained about one of the treatments that he was giving her for hypothyroidism. And I think within a couple of weeks, she withdrew the complaint. And the Collège de Médecine said, no, this is now in our hands. They put him on trial. I can mention his name. His name is Dr. Barry Brager. They put him on trial and they were going to take his license away because he practices something called orthomolecular medicine, which is a kind of preventative medicine that uses nutritional and vitamin supplements to maximize health. And he was trained as an MD. He received his medical degree in France and had been practicing in Quebec for decades. Now, I think the important thing to think about this is, you know, we can think about the recent case of, you know, Joyce Echaquan, you know, who died at the hands of biomedicine. Yeah. And nobody was brought to trial. Yet here is this man that has a very flourishing medical practice who is now being threatened with his license taken away. And to make a long story short, he was sanctioned for 18 months. He was not allowed to practice medicine for 18 months. But he had to go to great expense in terms of his trial and bring in experts from Europe and the United States to validate the kind of medicine he practiced. And the trial here, the doctor that was representing the province literally said, if I haven't heard of it, it doesn't exist, number one. And number two, if we don't have it in Quebec, then you're practicing, you know, a charlatan kind of medicine, which is kind of shocking to me. It almost feels like an 18th century trial. Or a 17th century, you know, trial for a practice that is accepted in many, many countries around the world, and where we have a shortage of people that practice family medicine, you know, like Dr. Brager.
So why do you think this is, Sandra? Why is the Collège de Médecine insisting upon controlling?
I think the Collège de Médecine here, number one, I think, you know, my parents always used to say that doctors have a God complex. And I think the Collège de Médecine here is very conservative. And it sets its standards to what I would call an extreme positivism, which is that there's only one way to treat something. And it's the way that they learned when they were in medical school. I also think, in a very strange way, I think the Collège de Médecine feels threatened by alternative practitioners. And when you look at it, I mean, there's plenty of alternative practitioners that practice in Quebec, you know, osteopaths, naturopaths, acupuncturists, traditional Chinese medical doctors, nutritionists, etc. But they're only allowed, you know, it's like they're allowed to go to the beach, but they're not allowed to step in the water.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That's a very good way of putting it.
I also think, if I can make the analogy, I also think in terms of Barry Brager's trial, I think he was set up as a scapegoat. I mean, the Chinese have this wonderful expression called you kill the chicken to frighten the monkey. And I think in this case, they were trying to make a case out of Dr. Brager to say, okay, the rest of you can't step out of line because we're going to take your license away. And I think to me, you know, for somebody that's come from, you know, I came into academia both from, you know, working in health clinics, you know, and then also I got a master's in public health and then worked in health policy for a number of years before I came back to anthropology. And what's always struck me in Quebec is if you have such an incredible shortage of family physicians, partly because the health budget, you know, going back into the, you know, the mid 80s, there was an effort to balance the budget, to have a zero deficit budget, and it was balanced on the back of the healthcare system. So I believe beginning in 1985 through about 1989, there was a massive shutdown of healthcare, of hospitals, of reducing, you know, physicians, nurses, et cetera. And we've never been able to catch up. So it doesn't make sense to me that you have this whole armamentarium of what maybe we would call paramedical professionals that could augment the system and provide, you know, screening and primary healthcare, rather than just what they did recently. They just announced that they're going to get rid of well baby exams because they're not useful.
I think it's really relevant what you're saying. I mean, do you realize that before 1999, a pregnant woman could not have a home birth in her home, in her own home? It was illegal. There was no place to train midwives. So many women were desperate to be trained, they couldn't be trained. So the only way that it could happen was if people were outside the door watching and guarding the door where the woman mm-hmm. was in labor. It was absurd.
Yes. So- and there's also, I mean, even today, you know, even though there are birthing centers and there are doulas and there are midwives, it's still contested. And I think, you know, I think it harks back to, you know, a colleague of mine was saying, you know, her father was part of the you know, medical regime that was trying to get rid of midwifery because he was saying so many women were dying on kitchen tables. And, you know, the data on that varies widely in terms of, you know, are women better off, you know, with midwives? Are women better off in, you know, tertiary care facilities? And, you know, one of the stories that I always love is a colleague of mine, this was about 15 years ago, you know, gave birth at the Royal Vic when it was still a Royal Vic. And her doctor was so busy that she said to her, if you don't deliver right this instant, I'm giving you a C-section because I don't have time to do a vaginal birth. And, you know, to me, it's just like, wow. And, you know, good on her. She delivered immediately. But I just thought that was so funny. I mean, that's the kind of story I've heard in very, very busy hospitals in China when I was there in the 1980s, you know, but we're talking about the 2000s in Quebec of, you know, just not having enough obstetricians and, not wanting to turn things over to midwives. And anytime there is a case, you know, where there is, you know, an infant mortality or infant distress, you know, immediately all the cards get brought out on the table about how horrible midwives are and how terribly untrained they are, etc. But we rarely hear about births, you know, where, you know, infants die in the hospital, and they do. My mother was a neonatologist. They definitely die in the hospital as well.
So how does Quebec compare to other places, Sandra?
Well, I think one thing that was interesting in doing a little bit of research for our interview is if you look at, let's say, naturopathy, right? Yeah. Five provinces recognize naturopaths in Canada and license them, and one, Nova Scotia, I think, regulates it. And one of the things that naturopaths have been trying in Quebec is to get licensed. And when you look at, you know, a lot of these naturopaths, I mean, they have four-year degrees, yes, and then they go on to have, you know, postgraduate additional work. So they got 7 years of training. And when you listen to some of these physicians, they act like, you know, somebody went to a night school and took a few courses for 6 months and then hung up a shingle. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't people that have done that, but if you don't regulate, if you don't even offer them the chance to license and regulate it, and that's what kind of doesn't make sense to me. Like, wouldn't you want to license and regulate it so that you could set the standards, you know, for the profession? And, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is a naturopath that I know was saying, you know, naturopaths in Ontario actually have quite a large kind of range of services they can provide. There are certain tests they can run, they can do well baby exams, they can do pap smears. There's a, you know, quite a number of medications and drugs they can prescribe. And in Quebec, if you're a naturopath and you want to run a blood test, you have to find a doctor in Ontario that will take you on. Then they can draw the blood in Quebec, and then they have to send it to Ontario to get analyzed because they don't have the rights in Quebec to use the laboratories here, which just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I mean, it's so many hoops to jump through. And, you know, to kind of say to somebody, yeah, you can sort of practice, you can practice your trade, but we're going to hog tie you in the meantime so that you can't get any diagnostic information, and then tell them that they're inadequate. it flabbergasts me.
Yeah, well, it's astounding, especially as there are many people that can't even find a doctor.
Yes.
And of course, during the pandemic, we're not even going to the doctor.
Right, right. And that has been again, harking back to the 1980s when there was this huge slash they slashed the number of family practice licenses they gave, they slashed the number of, nursing staff, et cetera. We've never really caught up. And so we have this magical wait list that you can put your name on. I mean, I've been on this wait list twice and I waited 3 years both times. Now they say right now the wait list is only a year and only a year wait. So my question from a health policy perspective is, why don't you utilize some of these, you know, trained alternative complementary, you know, doctors and have them do triage, you know, basic triage so that you can provide care. I mean, a lot of the reasons that people go to alternative practitioners is they give you more than 10 minutes. And, you know, what I discovered when I first came here, you know, when you go to a CLSC and they have 10 minutes, the most they're going to do is maybe take your blood pressure, maybe listen to you for 2 minutes and write a prescription. And I think one of the things that alternative healthcare has adopted, you know, is the Hippocratic idea of do no harm. And so let's figure out, you know, let's listen to the patient. Even William Osler used to say, you know, if you listen to the patient long enough, you will probably figure out what's wrong with them. And if you listen to them even longer, they will probably tell you how to cure them. And we've just lost this art in the sense that, and I remember when, you know, Gaétan Barrette was health minister, you know, medical students were up in arms because he had decided that appointments could move from 15 minutes to 10. And then I believe the compromise was 12. Well, 12 minutes is not a very long time to see somebody and figure out, you know, what's going on. And it's certainly not enough time to take a decent history.
I think what we're suffering from is when you're talking about the 80s, what happened then was that a lot of services were delisted. That was when they started to delist the services. Mm. So, for example, I know that they have on paper physiotherapy, but I think it's like an 18-month wait or something.
Right, right.
Of course, if you're in pain, there's no way that you can wait. But according to what you're saying, your options are even very limited in terms of alternative and complementary medicine as well.
Well, I don't think that the options are limited. I think the problem is they're in the private sector and they cost money. So if you don't have the resources, I mean, we were so adamant. I mean, early on, you know, there were a number of reports that were written. I mean, all of the medical reports that have been written in Quebec are always written by a physician, number one, except for maybe Pauline Monroy when she was health minister. And they're written in such a way that there was a point when Quebec in the 90s, I believe, began to look at kind of what's called private-public partnerships. And they started looking at Germany, they started looking at the UK, and they started looking at it. There's a very interesting health maintenance organization in the United States called Kaiser Health that provides wraparound services. And it's usually through your employer. Your employer, you know, buys into Kaiser. And Kaiser is amazing. They literally provide, you know, tip to tail, you know, birth to death services. And Quebec began to look into that, but there was so much resistance to it because of the fears of creating a two-tiered system. But what's interesting is we've already created a two-tier system by not examining that and by not figuring out, you know, what are some ways that we could have created these partnerships in order to ease the public system. I mean, I don't think it's an either or. And, you know, one of my examples is when I was looking for a physician, a friend of mine had suggested a practice in Laval that literally charged $10 a minute. I think it was 10, was it 10? No, it couldn't be $10 a minute. Maybe it was 10. It literally cost $600 an hour to be seen in this practice. I'm doing my math wrong here. And that's outrageous. That is really outrageous. And yet people keep saying to me, oh no, we don't want privatized care. Well, Quebec has a very large booming private healthcare sector.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Absolutely. I mean, don't forget that certain services like dental care has always been private.
Yes. Yes.
So we can't really say that we have totally free health care, but because we don't. And as you say, we have a two-tiered system.
We have a two-tiered system, even though people don't want to acknowledge that we have a two-tiered system. And the other question it comes down to is if we do have a two-tiered system, then why aren't we regulating private healthcare so that we at least can set some standards so that people are not charging these outrageous rates for those that, you know, for desperate people who, you know, are willing to pay?
Yes. So given this tremendous health crisis that we have at the moment, and of course, we always have people who are seriously ill, diseases like cancer, etc. What do you think the solution is for this, Sandra?
Well, I think it's complicated. I mean, looking from it from the outside as somebody coming from a country that has a vastly inequitable healthcare system, I think there are things that could be adopted. And one of the things that is being looked to is training nurse practitioners, you know, what they call the super infirmière. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, when I first got to McGill, I used to have a number of nurse practitioner students in my classes, and they used to say, we can't get jobs because there's not enough slots for us. And I think there's been a tremendous, I mean, even the nursing associations in Quebec were opposed to nurse practitioners when I first got here, and that has changed. So I think what you do is you create a triage system where you don't have to see a doctor every time, you know, you need medical care. I mean, there's plenty of allied healthcare professionals that could manage, you know, basic care so that people aren't rushing to the ER, you know, every time, you know, they have a torn finger or a broken limb. And there are some amazing clinics in town. I am now finally part of this amazing clinic called Refua Hased, which is in the Mile End area. It was mainly started by a group of Hasidic ambulance drivers in upstate New York as an advocacy organization for the Hasidic community. And it has branched into what I would call whole person care. It's one of the few clinics I've seen in Quebec that really provides whole person care. And I think they could be a model for clinics in Quebec. And I think, again, we've got to start thinking outside the box that it can't be, you know, the MD that has to run everything. There's no reason. I mean, and on northern, you know, in northern communities on Ontario, clinics are run by NPs. And when I worked in the Hawaiian Islands, when I was right out of my degree in public health, I actually worked for the Division of Maternal and Child Health for the Hawaii Health Department. And on, you know, the different five Hawaiian Islands, a number of nurse practitioners were the only medical personnel available, and they provided perfectly, you know, adequate, probably, you know, really good care. And they triaged people up. I mean, if there was a problem, they were then triaged to, you know, the largest city hospital. And then if there wasn't a hospital on that island, they were then medevaced, you know, to Oahu. So I think there's all kinds of models that could be used, but I think we're stuck. You know, a number of policy analysts have defined that we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because of politics, number one, and of not wanting to think outside the box, and because we're so mired in, you know, the politics and policies of the way healthcare runs, it is very difficult. Now, recently, you know, Christian Dubé, the new health minister, you know, has said, okay, we don't have enough nurses. Let's at least start increasing their salaries. Let's try and increase the number of nurses that are working full time. And I think a lot, and nurses have responded to this. But I think they've also said it's not just a question of money, it's the question of how they're treated. And, you know, a lot of the nursing staff, you know, they feel like they're just being treated like they're in a cattle car and nobody really cares.
Yeah, I think this gets back to the idea of the patriarchy. And the idea of
medical care is very much a patriarchal industry in general. But in Quebec, it's even writ large, you know, even more so. Yeah. I mean, you look at who's on the stage talking about COVID, except for Mylene Drouin. I mean, they're all men.
Yeah, that's a good point you're making. Yeah. I mean, there is this history, isn't there, of the church and the history of the priests. Everybody knows what's good for you. And they're men that know what's good for you.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I think, you know, I think that's one of the problems why nurses have had such a hard time, you know, gaining more power and influence, is because it is traditionally a female profession, whereas medicine is always seen as a more male profession. And even within medicine, you know, depending on what subspecialty you're in, you know, there are more men like in orthopedic surgery than there are in pediatric surgery.
Yeah, so there's a sort of status working there. But mm-hmm. I think in general, you know, the nurses' salaries are just abominably low.
They're terrible. And I think, you know, this idea that they're going to increase their salaries by $18,000 is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, but it's nothing.
But it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think the other thing that kind of strikes me about it is if we're constantly balancing the budget off of healthcare, then how can we ever expect anybody to be healthy? I mean, if we're constantly cutting off our nose to spite our face, you know, and at the same time, we're in a system that uses the absolutely most expensive means, which is sending people to the ER, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there should be community clinics like the clinic that I go to. I mean, they have a small surgery there, so they can, you know, sew people up and set bones, etc. There is no reason that those kinds of procedures have to be done in the emergency room. And, you know, the waits in the emergency rooms here, you know, can be absolutely outrageous and people die in them. I had a colleague who had a collapsed lung. And he had to keep saying to the staff, I know my lung is collapsed. My lung is collapsed. And nobody would believe him. I mean, he survived. He did get treated. He finally got somebody to pay attention. But it, you know, it's startling. And I think that's why I get kind of frustrated with this kind of dismissal of this whole armamentarium of, you know, alternative medicine as a complement to biomedicine. I'm not asking to get rid of biomedicine. I'm asking to treat it in a complementary fashion. And in 2016, Adam Gavzi, who is a dually trained family medicine doctor and has training in alternative medicine, you know, tried to put on a conference at McGill, and his goal was to provide more classes to family doctors at McGill, which was the program that he came out of. And the conference was heckled. The conference was heckled, and there was a protest by physicians and by the Office of Science and Society at McGill, opposing it, calling them charlatans.
That's horrifying.
You know, and so on the one hand, there's a reluctance to be able to even think about outside the box and alternatives. And then the other hand is just this absolute, like I said, positivist. There is one way to look at this and one way to do it, and that's it. And I think it's to our detriment. And I think it's, you know, to the bravery and the resilience of the alternative medical community, that there are so many of them that, you know, have survived in Quebec. I mean, there's many naturopaths in Quebec, and there are a group of naturopaths in Quebec who have, you know, graduated from colleges here and also in Ontario that are working. They said they're working with the Collège de Médecine to get licensed, but they're saying it's a very slow process and it may take, you know, another 5 years before they even reach an agreement. So we're talking, as my father used to say, the slow boat to China.
Exactly. And I mean, it's so ironic, you know, nobody's talking about the billions that we spend on armaments.
I know.
Now, I know. Here is a danger to public health.
Yeah.
Never there was. But right. People don't seem to make the connections in the right way. They just accept, you know, they're rather lazy. They just accept what the media says, which, of course, is never really on our side, or very rarely on our side.
Right. No, I think that's definitely true. And all of the, you know, the millions that we spend on construction in this province, you know, it's like, the sewer in front of my house got dug up 3 years in a row. You know, I mean, these kinds of things. I mean, I know we had the Charbonneau Commission, and I know we acknowledge that there is corruption in the construction industry. But I often wonder, you know, we spend so much money on that industry. Why can't we move some of that into healthcare? And I know the solution, like the Bloc in the last election, there's been a big push to try and get the federal government to do a higher transfer of payment to Quebec. But I'm not sure that money alone is going to solve the problem.
No, I think that you're right. It's more than money.
It's more than money. It's an attitude. You know, it's an attitude, and it's a kind of sensibility that there is only one kind of medicine, and it's our kind of medicine. And, you know, there was an effort, I forget what year it was, when they finally decided that pharmacists could have a little bit more say, and pharmacists could do basic diagnostics, they could check people's blood pressure, they could give, you know, vaccines. But interesting to me, they allowed that for pharmacists, but not for nurse practitioners. I mean, now I think nurse practitioners, you know, do have more leeway, but it was a huge, I mean, for somebody who came from the States who never saw anybody besides a nurse practitioner, I was kind of shocked when I got here in 2002 that they didn't really exist.
Yeah, and I think also when you talk about the pharmacists and the nurse practitioners, we are talking about sexism, because we think of the nurse practitioners as being women, and of course, pharmacists traditionally are men, so they would have more authority.
Right, and I think, you know, because of their training, they're seen as more legitimate. And nurse practitioners, you know, without recognizing that nurse practitioners actually have a lot more training in terms of diagnosing illness and treating disease than pharmacists do. I mean, I'm thankful that my local pharmacist, you know, can give out vaccines and can check blood pressure and can, you know, answer very basic questions about, you know, basic over-the-counter medications and such. But I was a little bit surprised that that was only extended to pharmacists.
And only recently.
And, you know, thank goddess for us, it happened, you know, during COVID, because they, you know, they were the kind of forefront of being able to vaccinate the population, that you could just go to your local pharmacy.
Absolutely.
You know, which really made a big difference, rather than, you know, standing in line at Hotel Dieu or the Palais de Congrès for several hours.
Exactly. So do you want to wrap this up? Is there anything else that you have to say?
Well, one thing I did want to say is, you know, there have been some very brave Quebecers. And one person I would really like to give a shout out to is, there's this wonderful book, one of the first books I read in French here, by a, she used to have a, I think she still has a column in Le Devoir. She's a journalist who had three different kinds of cancers and felt like the cancer treatment was killing her. So she turned to alternative care and she wrote a book about it. And her name is José Blanchette. Oh, yes. And she wrote this wonderful book called Je ne sais pas prendre l'œuf, mais je sais quand il est pourri. You know, I don't know how to, you know, kind of make an egg or produce an egg, but I know when it's rotten. And, you know, she's been sort of one of the advocates, you know, trying to promote all alternative healthcare. And I also think, you know, the clinics that are, you know, trying to provide alternative care, and the one clinic that was trying to provide, you know, complementary and alternative medicine. And I'm just hoping that more of these can be integrated, and that there can be, you know, an effort to kind of just open the curtain a little tiny bit, and kind of see the benefits. I mean, I used to have, you know, one of my first physicians when I was here, I felt like he used to write in the chart, harass patient about acupuncture. And every time I went in, he would say, oh, But acupuncture, you just can't prove it through evidence-based medicine. And he said, yeah, you know, I could kind of press on this point and it's going to do something. And I said, how can you dismiss, you know, hundreds of years of efficacy? And he just wouldn't even listen. Obviously, I did not continue as a patient. But it's fascinating to me how, you know, acupuncturists too. I mean, Montreal has a very thriving acupuncture community, and they are licensed. And they are not covered by the régie, but they are covered by, you know, a lot of private insurances.
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, all of these are just, you know, misunderstood. You know, it has a very different, what we would call a very different epistemology, a very different way of knowing. You know, it doesn't have a kind of division of the body into organs and parts and limbs. It defines it in terms of, you know, different energies. And I think there, you know, when you look at, you know, something like neuroscience today, you know, neuroscientists are working with, you know, acupuncturists and learning much more about these energy fields. And when you go, you know, to other parts of science, there is this cooperation and there is this, you know, integrative studies. But when it comes to primary care, it seems to go, you know, down the rabbit hole and it stays there. So that's, you know, disappointing.
Well, thank you very much, Sandra, for guiding us through all this.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I hope this is useful to your listeners, and I hope some people will go out and buy José Blanchet's book, and that we will just continue in this struggle.
They say in time it fades, forget where you hurt me. Why can't I look away from the face I see? Sight on those days we spent in the park. Saw you chasing dreams down the boulevard. And I saw you're already forgiven. It takes so long to say it, already forgiven. How long I let it stay? I can't escape my name. Tired of drinking bitter wine, when the cup it breaks in my hand each time, when the cup it breaks in my hand each time, telling me you're already forgiven. Will it take me years to say it already forgiven? How could I could not have foreseen.
You ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in sonic bliss? Are you ready for CKUT? We're ready for you. 90.3 on your FM dial.
McGill University's fourth annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sedalio Fazio. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
When you tell your girlfriend, "Get changed, you dress like a tramp. Change your password so I can see your messages." When are you going to change your mind, you stubborn idiot? Change your attitude when you talk to me. Change your friends. You better change your tone of voice. It's not up to her to change. It's up to you. Violence against women stops now. Talk about it. Do something about it. And call SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gaila Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweetsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason Whitebear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki Waku Maganak, Nadine, and Wendin Naganag. How Mataki was. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewewan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here and we're very learned people. We're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays. And that's just us as this language, as this. And I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tansi, how? Wuju Anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you. I'd like to say, and that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Hi. Thank you.
You have just heard at Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, back to Amandla, your weekly news show with news and analysis about the continent of Africa. Today, we are doing a rebroadcast because our friend and comrade, Stéphane Christophe from Free City Radio, has pulled together a panel with the help of Alternatives, the organization, the activist organization that dates back actually to the anti-apartheid era. And they have a wonderful panel of people from Kenya who are talking about activism in the time of COVID in Kenya. And one of those panelists is our friend and contributor, Zara Mulud. So we're very excited to have the chance to broadcast this for you. It's from Free City Radio, which was played this afternoon on their program. And we're rebroadcasting it tonight. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Good day, everybody. Thank you for joining our panel today. This is part of a series hosted by Alternatives in collaboration with CKUT Radio in Montreal, and particularly the program Free City Radio, which is a program that explores the intersections of activism and the arts, but also tries to highlight voices from around the world. The webinar today is looking at the ways that activists are responding to the pandemic crisis.